Hello and welcome to the Business Analysis Conference podcast. My name is Judy Rees and I'm here with Mark Harrison of the BBC. Mark, can I ask you to say what it is you do, please?
Yes, sure. My job title is Creative Director, Innovation for Project North and for BBC Vision. So it's a long job title. What that actually means is that I'm the person from the creative community, from the production community, who's responsible for driving change and modernisation for in-house production at the BBC in areas like drama and factual and comedy and entertainment, but also responsible for designing new ways of working at our new broadcast centre in Salford, which will be opening in 2011. That's the Project North bit.
That's exciting.
Yeah, brilliant. Fantastic.
One of the biggest media projects there's ever been, I think.
Yeah, and it's made the bold claim ahead of moving in that it will be the most advanced digital production centre in the world. One of those kinds of claims that, you know, very senior people make on various conference stages over the years, and then somebody has to try and make this become a reality, and I guess that person, at least in part, is me.
And you're one of the keynote speakers at the Business Analysis Conference.
I am, yes.
And you've chosen quite a provocative title, I think.
Yes, that's right, yes. Well, it all comes out of the time I've spent in the BBC, where I've been for the last 7 years, trying to bring technical change and modernisation, which has partly been driven by the need to save money, but just as much driven by the need to serve audiences in new ways. You know, it's a creative drive as well as an economic drive. And it's, you know, it's been pretty painful, and it goes on being painful, and it really fascinates me that that creative people who one might think of as being almost by definition people who are intrigued by new things actually seem to be so conservative about how they do things and about the tools that they use to do things.
What do you think prompts that conservatism?
Well, I think there's a number of things. It's partly because certainly in a broadcast world, everything you make is made under considerable constraints and time pressure. And that's sort of always been the case to a degree, but it's become more and more true, just because budgets have got tougher and the quality of what we make actually has got higher. You know, for all the people bellyache about the quality of TV, actually, if you compare it with what was going out 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it's far, far better, both in its editorial quality, but also in its production value.
It looks better.
It just looks better and feels better, and it's better executed with far greater professionalism than it used to be. But that's done under considerable pressure. And so, you know, when there are so many constraints and so much to achieve, it becomes inevitable that people want the kind of safety and reassurance of knowing that the tools that they're going to use work. And because they tend to go from one project to the next very quickly, the notion that anybody should interrupt that flow by bringing in something they've got to learn that's new is just, you know, beyond the pale.
And then the cry goes up, why are you doing this to us?
Exactly. Why are you doing this to us? You know, why are you either trying to, you know, impede us from making programmes, or why are you trying to, you know, erode, destroy my creative ability?
When you think you're trying to...
Actually, to liberate it. Actually, you know, when I was a director, I was always very interested in finding new technologies, because A, they could give me a creative edge, they could make my output more distinctive, and B, because if they were ones that save money, then I could kind of leapfrog some of the problems in my budget. If I could find, you know, one part of my budget that could be really dramatically reduced in cost, that would mean I wouldn't have to slightly reduce all the others. Yeah, so I'd rather locate my saving in one big place if possible. And I guess as somebody who now tries to bring about change, that's part of my obsession is, you know, let's not, in the jargon, salami slice every single thing that we do, every budget line, just brought down by 10%, which just sort of makes them all become more constrained and constraining and kind of annoying and difficult. Let's instead look for what are the big process and technology leaps we can make that suddenly liberate, you know, 20% of your budget in one go, and then free it up to do more interesting things creatively.
Mm-hmm. And in your talk at the conference, you're going to be talking about what's needed to get to those kind of creative leaps in terms of technology.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, because I think there's sort of a bit of a war going on now, certainly in the creative sector. I could well believe it's true elsewhere, between, if you like, those who do and those who analyse the doing. Mm. And you know, my view of this is that in media, for all sorts of reasons, we lived in a world that had very, very little discipline, very, very little business analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And that came to really quite an abrupt end. I guess John Burt was the start of it in the BBC. You know, he was the first person to start insisting that we really precisely measured what we did. But in the late 90s and early 2000s, the measurement culture has come very fiercely into media, and particularly into the BBC, and that's a double whammy of being a public sector organisation, with now very strong needs to kind of report to government, and of course very strong accountability in the press. So you've got that on top of, you know, what's sort of happening more broadly in the sector.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've gone in the space of probably only about 10 years from measuring very weakly and poorly to measuring very fiercely. And my contention is that although that was much needed in many regards, it's actually getting to the point where it's in danger of being the thing that makes us unable, actually, to make the really big creative leaps in change, to really achieve the things that are going to be good for us and for our audiences.
So it's the analysis itself that's the obstacle.
We're getting very close to that. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, even I, as somebody who's come from the creative community, have tended to feel it often that, in fact, the big barrier has been the creative staff themselves and their mindsets that we talked about just now. That still remains true to an extent, but to be honest, they might appear rather well justified in holding to their claim that things are being done to them, when their primary experience of change is actually a kind of a wall of analysis.
Is there anything else about that wall of analysis? Fascinating image.
Well, one of the things I've tended to say to colleagues is that the analysis part should be largely invisible.
Mm.
It's not that it shouldn't happen. It's imperative that it should happen. You know, it's not that I'm saying we should kind of completely go back to the kind of bad old days. It's very important that it should happen, but it shouldn't be... It should be what's under the bonnet.
Mm-hmm.
Analysis and consultancy has become so embedded in what we do that actually it's becoming visible above the surface. You know, we are actually now wheeling, you know, creative staff into rooms face to face with business analysts and consultants who are then speaking to them in their language.
In that kind of business language.
Yeah. Which is complete gobbledygook to anybody outside that world, let alone to creative people. But to creative people, it's like red rag to a bull. And you know, my contention is that interface shouldn't need to happen. It needs to be mediated. So then the question is, by what? You know, what is the mediation?
Or by whom?
And, you know, without kind of going into too much detail now, I'd say, in essence, it needs to be mediated by people who have an intuitive understanding of the change need, who can establish and set the kind of the big change drivers, and through that the most likely solutions, and then use the analysis to validate those assumptions. Mm-hmm. So what we need to stop doing is, which we tend to do sometimes, you know, even in the BBC, or perhaps particularly in public service organisations like the BBC, is we think that if we analyse hard enough, we will both, you know, spot the change need and the change solution. Mm. And we absolutely will not. You know, all we'll manage to do is we'll manage to get a probably pretty accurate picture of the kind of processes that happen, and through that we might spot some areas for improvement. We might, or we might not, because there's still something else that overlays that, which is an intuitive understanding of why you're performing those processes. So let me put it to you another way, which is this, that in some of the projects I've done in the past in the BBC, because I have been responsible for some pretty big technology changes, we have taken individual programs, you know, quite famous brands like Time Watch, for instance, and we have analysed the processes to the nth degree. And I can tell you, if you analyse the making of kind of standard 60-minute documentary like a Time Watch, you will, and you do, literally cover a big wall in charts that have got very small writing on them. Mm. Now, that's not how it feels to make a Time Watch. Actually, if you've made a lot of documentaries, making a Time Watch feels quite easy. In fact, if you've done it for a few years, you'll probably find it almost boringly easy. And you would intuitively feel the number of processes to be quite few. Mm. Because you think of them in blocks, and you know they're unconscious competence. Mm. So what we, in danger of doing with too much analysis, is actually we try and turn unconscious competence into conscious competence, and that's a little bit like taking a sports person whose brilliance comes from not thinking, from reflexive action, and turning it into reflective action, and almost certainly then fluff their shot or fluff their serve or whatever
you do. So trying to break down Tiger Woods' golf swing.
You'll kill his swing. You'll become a bad golfer, or a less good golfer overnight if you do that. So somehow you've got to find a way of... Let's say that Tiger's got a problem. Mm-hmm. Let's say that Tiger actually feels he needs to change his swing. Okay, now, you know, probably a coach would work with him to break that swing down and find out the bits of it that aren't quite right. But I wouldn't mind betting that coach, first of all, will take a look at the big picture and get a sense of where it is in that swing that Tiger's now going wrong. I very much doubt that he will come with a completely neutral view and just start to break the swing down.
Because the chunk size is wrong. You can't ask the sports person to break it down to the level of detail that somebody building a computer system, somebody wanted to design Tiger Woods on the Wii or whatever, would need.
Actually, computer systems are quite a good example in this regard, because, you know, why is Mac more exciting and stimulating and creative to use than Microsoft? I'm sure that deep techies would say it is something to do with, you know, the exact way in which the operating system works, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's about the way it feels, and that's really difficult to put into words what it is about the way it feels. But it is, it's a set of assumptions. It's a world, and it goes way, way beyond, you know, the circuit boards that are inside the machine.
So perhaps business analyst needs to brand itself and give itself a surface structure which enables it to interface with creatives in a more useful way.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I have encountered, well, in fact, now I've developed quite a good radar, I think, for those kinds of people. Mm. Because you do come upon them. In fact, I think, broadly speaking, I encountered two different kinds of, I must confess, you know, out of ignorance, I rather think of kind of analysts and consultants in a slightly similar box, which may be my mistake, but I'm afraid I do. And there's the one kind is the kind that says, you know, here are a set of analytical tools. I wish you to help me to apply them to this area of your work. And the other is the kind that says, tell me about your area of work.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a lot of listening. And because they're good listeners, they start to learn how to speak back to me and my colleagues in our language.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, they say, okay, I wonder if you might find the following tools helpful to you, you know, in teasing out this problem. Those people are completely fantastic to work with because they take our intuition and then they correct the problem you have around intuition, which is intuition without any structure can just be a thought that gets lost. Yeah. So they give structure and body and process to the intuition. Mm-hmm. That is incredibly valuable.
So those people are able to keep the analysis under the hood.
Exactly.
They allow the creative people to do their creative thing.
Exactly.
They provide that mediation.
Yeah.
And the magic just happens.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And at the conference, you'll be telling people how to do that.
Well, I'll try and be a bit more specific about, you know, what that might kind of look and feel like and perhaps a bit more about the kinds of personality types that one might be looking for. Because, you know, I'm saying this from the point of view of somebody who, you know, perhaps rather vainly thinks that they're intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I try and imagine what it's like if I was on the other side of the fence and I'm going in looking for the intuitive person in a sea of individuals in a new organisation that perhaps I've come in to try and help, well, how do I do that? How do I support them?
What kind of skills, what kind of techniques would somebody use to find the people they need to talk to?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so that's something we'll explore a bit more, maybe.
That sounds really exciting. And it touches on the kind of territory that I work in, so that's exciting for me too. So.
Good.
I should be at your talk.
Good. Audience of at least one.
I should imagine there's going to be quite a lot of people at your talk as well.
Well, I hope so. And, you know, I'll make the promise now that it'll be quite lively. And there might be a bit of gentle audience interaction, but don't worry, it won't be like being at a sort of terrible stand-up comedy gig. I won't pick on anybody, but we'll try and do a bit of stuff together.
I'm really looking forward to it. This is going to be a very exciting conference as a whole, and I think your talk's going to be a major contribution to it.
I hope so. Thanks.